Welcome back to the Golf Beneath the Surface podcast. My name is Raymond Pryor with you for episode 3 of Habits. With me is my co-host Chase. Real quick recap on Habits. The stage 1, we talked about mapping them, which is basically taking them out of subconscious and automatic processing and into conscious awareness simply by paying attention to them. Stage 2 is we're actually paying attention to the cause and effect, which shows our old brain in the language that it speaks. This doesn't feel as good or work nearly as well as you think it actually does. So essentially, we are paying attention to a habit in a way that makes it less automatic, then paying attention to it in a way that our brain becomes disenchanted with it. And when it becomes less appealing to our brain, we introduce stage 3, which is we're ready for a better option, or we might say an upgrade. But without taking things out of automatic processing and without showing our brain that it's not nearly as rewarding as you think it is in a language that it actually speaks, it's very difficult for our brain to be open to something else.
I was thinking I'm not quite ready to do my dissertation on habits quite yet for my PhD in golf instructor, but I'm getting closer. Okay. I'm getting better on habits. This stuff's fascinating.
Okay. So what does stage 3 of habit change look like? So that we might think of trying to change a habit in 3 stages. First stage, conscious awareness. Stage 2, conscious awareness of the cause and effect, the actual reward that it's getting. So once we've kind of disenchanted an idea by, again, paying attention to how it doesn't feel very good for us and it doesn't work very well in relation to what we want, our brain starts to go, okay, I don't really like this. What else you got for me? So you might think about this like if it was a club fitting example. Okay, I'm aware of the driver I'm currently playing. I'm aware that it's underperforming relative to what I'm looking for. What else you got for me? But that what else you got for me has to fit a certain criteria. And very specifically for our brain, when we offer it an upgrade or a better option, it needs to fit 2 criteria, or really 3 criteria. 1, it needs to be internally driven, so something that we can control. 2, it needs to feel better. It doesn't need to feel good necessarily, but it needs to feel better than the previous option. And 3, it needs to work better. Not necessarily a guarantee or an absolute all-encompassing, this is so much better all the time in all circumstances, but just, is this a better option relative to moving me toward the things that I want? Okay. So before we kind of get into how to do that, it would be important to, again, understand how our brain and nervous system works a little bit. We've talked about our comfort zone, growth zone, and the danger zone for us and our nervous system. And what that looks like is if you drew a target, and the bullseye area, or that bullseye dot or circle, would be our comfort zone. So again, it's at the center because that's where we feel safest in our comfort zone. So if we're going to our ancestral and evolutionary roots, that's the cave. So that's our safe space. Just outside of that is our growth zone. So this would be the ring around the bullseye. And in our growth zone, this is where we can explore better options, engage with new things, learn new things, and operate in different places. The challenge about our growth zone is that discomfort, uncertainty is part of it. And there's oftentimes, there's a less of a layer of safety, or that we might say there's more risk and we are more vulnerable than when we're in our comfort zone. And then outside of that is our danger zone or threat zone, where there's so much either real or perceived threat that, again, remember, when we perceive enough threat, whether it's real or not, we don't go back to our growth zone. We typically jump all the way back to our comfort zone. Okay. So if we're looking for like a physiological example for this, if I was trying to get stronger and I was doing push-ups and it's comfortable for me, as soon as it started to get uncomfortable, like my muscles started to fatigue a little bit or they got a little bit spicy, I stopped. I'm not actually going to get stronger over time because I didn't sit in my growth zone long enough for my muscles to reap the rewards of that discomfort, of that fatigue, and then actually grow back and get stronger. Well, the same works for us cognitively, emotionally, when it comes to our habits, is if I don't go into my growth zone long enough and understand that, yes, there's a little bit more risk in here, but it's not nearly what danger zone type of risk, and I don't stick with this discomfort or sit in this uncertainty long enough to reap the benefits of it, I can't grow. So if we're looking for what is a better option in terms of our habits, we're looking for internal behaviors that allow us to psychologically, emotionally, and perhaps physically sit in our growth zone, which means engaging with discomfort, uncertainty, and a little bit of risk and vulnerability long enough to actually get the benefits, to have a different experience, see growth, see change. That's what allows our growth zone to expand. And then oftentimes the things that we used to think were very threatening, like certain triggers or certain internal and external triggers, they don't have the same effect for us. So again, we're not trying to talk our way into it. We're actually engaging in a way where we are psychologically, perhaps literally or figuratively, sitting in our growth zone a little bit longer. So if we're talking about a better option, we need behaviors that we can control, internally driven, that feel better than the behaviors that we are typically engaged with and work better than they did before, so we can sit in this growth zone long enough for us to have a different experience that is in line with the directions that we want to go.
So I want to add real quick, when you talk about growth zone or setting in what we've termed in the past, like setting in the struggle, not bailing out, not getting out of it too soon. We cover that in depth. So if you guys haven't listened to episode 2 of the podcast, Stress, Nerves, and Anxiety, Doc talks about that takes a deep dive, goes into detail about kind of what that looks like, the difference between the three and what it's like to sit in the struggle and not bail out, not jump ship.
So we might say that the behaviors we're looking for as better options for us are the types of behaviors that allow us to engage with stress in a way that doesn't cause us to bail out or try to bail out sooner. So this is why our avoidance-based behaviors in thriving-based settings aren't very effective, because they're not trying to help us stay in this thing and pursue something better or new or what we deem success. Avoidance-based strategies, by definition, are trying to get us to avoid threat, stress, and all these types of things that are part of high performance, but are not conducive to a certain level of comfort for us. So it grinds my gears a little bit on TV when I hear the announcers talking about, it's about whoever can get comfortable first, or you got to be comfortable being uncomfortable, which the underlying idea is you're still searching for a certain layer of comfort, when if they really understood how our nervous system works, high performance is not about being comfortable. Yep. It's perhaps nice when we feel it at times, but nobody performs at their best without an underlying layer of either active engagement and repeated engagement with discomfort, or the bottom lines. Really what happens is it's not about who gets comfortable first. It's who's willing to sit in on discomfort first, who has the advantage and isn't seeking comfort or certainty or the quote unquote guarantees of safety that high performance does not offer.
For sure.
Right. Okay. So really what we're talking about is, after I've mapped my habits in stage one by bringing them out of automatic processing, again, that's us writing out trigger, behavior, reward for the things that we are mapping. Stage two is still the same, trigger, behavior, reward, but now I'm asking myself these two questions that bring in my direct experience in the language my old brain speaks, which is, what does it feel like and what am I actually getting? So again, I have my felt sensory experience with something, and also, is the cause and effect of this behavior, what it's actually producing and getting for me, in line with what I actually want? So essentially, does it feel good and does it work well? If the answer is no, and we show our brain over and over again, it's ready to move on to something else once we show it that enough. Again, this is our disenchantment process. Yep. So stage three is, can I then give my brain a better option? Because now it's open to it and it's perhaps receptive to a new behavior, but it's got, again, it has to be internally driven. So something that I can respond to triggers with. So an internal behavior. And then two, does it actually feel better? Not necessarily comfortable or certain, but just better than the alternative. And then three, is it something that is actually getting the types of cause and effect that is more likely to move me toward the things that I really want when I'm sitting in that growth zone over time?
So how would this analogy work? We've realized we now hate our job. We're ready to look for a new job. We need to find one that makes more money. We enjoy what we're doing more and we work less hours. It's kind of like has totally. To match up.
Right. Yep. So let's say I've paid attention over time to how, like, here's my job. Well, you might even just say stage one is just paying attention to what is my job? What is it like every day? And then you go, ugh, I don't know if I like that. Stage two is paying attention to it. This doesn't pay well enough. I don't like the work I'm doing. I don't find it rewarding. And I don't like the location it's in, et cetera. All these things over and over again. And if you show yourself over and over again, it becomes less appealing. Then the better option is, well, what would actually feel better? What would be more rewarding work for me? What would be paying better? What would be a better location? What would be something that I want to experience as far as my job goes? So an excellent analogy. Yeah,
cool.
Okay. So let's start with a couple of different, we have kind of four primary options that are better for us relative to things like anxiety, frustration, that harsh inner dialogue, and many of the habits that tend to disrupt golf more than facilitate good golf. The first, we've talked about 1,000 times on this show, Chase, is just being grounded, meaning being present. So again, if you think about a behavior like anxiety, anxiety is by definition worry about the future. And on a very fundamental level, Chase, if I asked you, what time frame is golf more enjoyable in, being present or being anxious? You would say?
Present.
Being present. Now, is being present always comfortable? Nope.
No.
What's more comfortable, though, being anxious or being present?
More comfortable is 100% being present.
Being present, right? So again, it's not that present feels totally comfortable for us. It's easy all the time, but it is clearly a better feeling, a better sensory experience than anxiety. On a neurological level, the reasons behind that is anxiety is all adrenaline, which does not feel good. Being present is a high dopaminergic state for us, which is a feel-good chemical for our brain. Yeah,
and,
go ahead.
And what's funny about that is, like, a lot of times when we are present, it feels the worst when we're sometimes playing our best. What I mean by that is, like, when we get up to the lead and we're like, hey, I'm present, I'm on time. Oh, crap, I'm in the lead, or I'm tied for the lead, or I'm one back. That's when a lot of times it can almost not feel good, even though that's just a lot of times the nerves or whatever. But that's still better than if we're off time. Once we get there, now we're like, oh, gosh, now what do I do? You know, now I'm worried about the future, or I'm worried about what happened in the past, all that stuff.
And I might even point out that when we see that we're in the lead or playing well, oftentimes what makes us feel anxiety about that is because we are projecting the future in a way that is, uh-oh, what do I got to do to not screw this up?
Yeah,
or correct. What happens if someone catches me, or so on and so forth, where now we're actually going, uh-oh, I'm in my growth zone and things have gotten a little bit more stressful. Again, stress is duration and intensity of demand.
Yep.
And holding a lead has more duration and intensity of demand than chasing a lead when you don't, quote unquote, have anything to lose, right?
For sure.
So what feels better for us is being present relative to the vast majority of unproductive, especially internal habits. And if I asked you, Chase, what time frame psychologically do you play your best golf in, meaning what works better, dwelling on the past, playing in the present, or forecasting the future, which one would you say?
Playing in the present.
Right. So again, the two languages that our old brain speaks is what feels better, what works better. Being present checks off both of those boxes, and we are in control of our focus, so that is internally driven. So in terms of being grounded in the present and whatever means by which we do that, it checks all three boxes for being a better option for how our brain chooses what is actually a better option for us. And then if we're also talking about, well, what time frame is most conducive to a more enjoyable experience and a higher level of performance, being present is that option, right? So the reason many people have difficulty moving from anxiety to being present isn't just learning how to be present more. It's they haven't disenchanted themselves enough with the idea of being anxious in the first place. And their brain still thinks it's a pretty good idea because it still thinks, oh, you're doing something to create a sense of certainty or a sense of comfort, or you're trying to, it'll do something to make sure I don't screw up. And we have to show it over and over again. No, it is absolutely not. And I do not like how this feels. That way, when you present it with, oh, what does being present feel like? Oh, I like that a lot better. What do you actually get when you're in the present? Oh, I play a whole lot better too. And the experience is more motivating, more enjoyable, more engaging, etc. All of that stuff matters in terms of your brain then going, oh yeah, this is a much better option, which is again, how we learn a new habit, which is another way of saying the better option is more reinforcing than the previous.
Okay, so quick question. So when we say our four primary options, the first one's being present on time, being grounded, what are we necessarily trying to change? So if we go back to level one habits, we've got a behavior or a trigger behavior reward. Are we trying to change the behavior? Are we trying to change the overall, call it the overall habit? What are we trying
to change? We are trying to change the habit. The habit is all three of those elements, trigger, behavior, reward.
Okay.
But the key here is we are now inserting a new behavior, but after the reward has been lowered.
Lessened.
Okay. So essentially, I have showed my brain, you respond to this trigger with this unproductive behavior. This unproductive behavior feels worse and does not work. Here's one that does. Let's do this instead in a way where your brain goes, oh, I like that better.
And hopefully it then grabs other triggers and puts it under on time and being grounded and present.
Exactly. Well, it will start to generalize again, right? And if you took all of our behaviors, you could have an infinite number of internal and external triggers, but to our brain, they all fall under just a couple of categories, which is really risk, vulnerability, effort, and sacrifice, really. Okay. So when I'm at risk, so basically score counting for us just means you're at higher risk than you were when you were on the range. And that's the trigger. And my new behavior is I'm present in that. I don't feel the need to worry about the future before it gets here. And that feels better and works better for me. You only have to do that a couple of times before your brain goes, oh, I like the reward that comes with that. The challenge is you're going to perhaps have to rinse and repeat enough times for that to actually become the new response that you get into. And that can vary in amounts of time for people. The more consistent you are with it, the faster it goes.
Okay.
Right. So that would be option number one. And for those wondering, like, well, isn't it? And by the way, there are a variety of means that you can be present. So that's focusing on your breath. We've talked about kind of mindful breathing and centered breathing on this show before. Not the only means, but the way that we usually become present is by bringing our focus to something physical in our environment. And for those wondering, like, well, isn't that just trying to distract yourself from the outcomes? No, because when we're present, we're actually bringing ourselves into our experience, not out of it, right? Okay. So again, if you think about our evolutionary and ancestral roots, if we were going to venture out of the cave, if we were forecasting the future or dwelling on the past, we weren't going to venture very far. So we were trying to get out of the experience before it even starts. For us to venture out of the cave, we had to actually be focused on what was in front of us when it was actually focused. And this is part of what allowed humans to be able to not just survive, but become a thriving species on the planet, is it learned to explore faster than other species did, in a way where it was able to focus on what's in front of it without constantly being on guard, even though we still have that built in. And so again, here we see why being present for us is such a valuable habit to create in thriving based settings, because it allows us to be in the experience without multitasking with timeframes that don't exist, which is just another ejection strategy for us.
Sure.
Okay. Option number two, we have talked about 1,000 times on this show too, is acceptance, which is I'm willing to experience the discomfort, the uncertainty, the risk, the vulnerability, and everything that comes with these experiences. So that's the risk of being judged by other people, the vulnerability that it comes with that, the competitive risk, the social risk, the possibility of hitting a poor shot, possibility of someone having a comment about it, the possibility of repeating our past in our future. The more we are willing to accept the things that we don't want, again, that doesn't mean that you like it, that you don't care, that you're settling for less, you're resigning yourself to less, or that you're comfortable with it. It means you're open to the possibility that it might happen. That limits the multitasking. And again, we'll do our actual real life check. Chase, when you've played golf with a high level of acceptance, how does that feel?
Free.
Free. And do you like the feeling of freedom or constriction?
Freedom.
Freedom. And where do you play better golf? Resisting all the outcomes you don't want, or accepting the possibility and the occasional time that it does actually happen?
100% acceptance, final answer.
Right. And so really what we're talking about here is what are the behaviors that actually feel better and actually work better? Not some conceptual understanding from a textbook that Raymond may have referenced before, but in my real felt and actual performance experience. And that you might say at times where I've been willing to accept those things, that actually did come with some failure or some mistakes. And even in those times, I would say, what's better, trying to resist those even after they've already happened, or actually accepting them and using them as an opportunity to move on? Which one works better and which one feels better? One isn't necessarily going to feel good and one's not necessarily going to feel bad, but one is almost always better for us. And our brain is always looking for better, provided we are offering it to it. And again, better is relative to what it is that you want and the experience that you have, right?
Okay. So I got a bone to pick with you now.
Yeah, do it.
So we have been preaching on time and acceptance on this podcast for over, I think, a year now. We started about this time last year.
Oh, happy anniversary, guy.
Happy anniversary. It's been so fun. So we've been preaching on time and acceptance. And you just made me set through two. This is our third week of habits. And you know how much I disdain the starting out in habits, because it's so freaking confusing. And you're coming back to the first two primary options to get rid of the bad habits are to be more on time and to accept more. So here's my fun bone to pick kind of question for you is, like, do we need to know our habits if our goal is always to stay on time and to accept all outcomes? Like, do we need to have it do we need to go through the habit mapping if in the end we're trying to be on time and we're trying to accept all?
You might, right? Like, so if you have, we'll use anxiety as a habit. If you have established a level of anxiety as a habit, mapping it is probably still going to be the fastest, most efficient route to being able to get to something like being on time and acceptance. Again, because your brain has already laid down a neurological framework to produce anxiety as the response to a series of triggers for reasons it thinks are really helping.
Okay.
For some people, the conceptual understanding, like, oh yeah, obviously being accepting is way more enjoyable or whatever. And it goes very fast, right? Like, I've got one client on the PGA Tour. We talked about acceptance one time. It clicked for him. It is now the default setting, even though he's had a history of kind of avoidance and resistance in the past. For other people, it takes longer because, again, it's not just can I replace one with the other. It's I have to move off of the first one in the first place before I'm open. Again, feel like it's the golf ball you've been playing your entire life. It's to your brain. It's super familiar. It's predictable. Even if it's shittily familiar and predictable, it's still predictable and familiar. And to our brain, familiarity and predictability equates to safety, even if it doesn't actually do that.
No, that makes sense. So how ingrained we are in what we've done in the past will dictate whether or not you do habit mapping with your clients.
Correct. And by the way, depending on how any conversation I'm having with clients is going to have some level of this habit mapping in it, whether we are actually, that is the primary we're writing out. If you were to listen to a conversation with a client, you would hear quite often, what did it feel like playing through anxiety?
Yeah.
It felt terrible. And you might ask, well, why would you ask that question? Of course, it feels terrible. Yeah. Yes, it does. I want them to pay attention to that.
Yeah, that's the mapping.
When you play through anxiety, what kind of swings do you make? Awful swings. Yeah. The ones I don't want. Oh, interesting. Why? I want them consciously paying attention to awful that option is. Then I would also highlight, oh, you played a couple of holes for whatever reasons. You played a couple of holes. You were really accepting and really present. What did that feel like? Oh, a whole lot better. Interesting. What can we learn from this? Oh, and what kind of swings did you make? Oh, all of a sudden your swing came back magically. Interesting. What can we learn from this? Right. So I'm highlighting these. Essentially what I'm doing is I'm giving updated reward values by asking questions that get into their direct experience with two different psychological states.
Totally get it. I'm just pissed at you that we're going down this big, dark, deep dive hole into habits. And then our first two primary fixes for the habits are being on time and accepting all outcomes. Yeah. It's fascinating. You sorry dog. I was waiting for something more than this, like look in a mirror and tell myself how pretty I am.
Yeah. That one again is, you would have to be pretty for it to work, Chase. So you can see why we didn't go there.
Sorry. Tall, how tall I am. There we go.
All right, cool. Let's get into the, so these are the two that we have beat to death on this podcast. And the reason, again, it's not my personal opinion about these, the research behind them, what it does to our brain, what it does to our body, to our performance is indisputable. These are why being grounded and being accepting are the two variables that create stable confidence. They are internally driven. They feel better than the alternative. So our brain likes them, and they work better in terms of producing performance in a much more stable way than most of the habits we have trying to create certainty and comfort and all of these things that don't actually do that. Okay. Option number three for us is one that a lot of my clients really like, which we've kind of discussed a little bit without knowing it through our last couple episodes. And it's curiosity, but a very specific type. So we as humans have access to two different types of curiosity. The first one is what we call deprivation curiosity, which is this really judgmental kind of single point ended curiosity. It's the type of curiosity we have when we're going, okay, well, what's the name of that one actress in that one show? Kind of like your trivia based curiosity. And the other is kind of this judgmental, like, why am I not playing better curiosity, right? Like, so what this is it's kind of that scratchy curiosity that scratch can only be itched if you get to the end point. And so this can be a really valuable means of curiosity for us, but it's not very spacious, which if we're looking at what our better options in terms of our habits are, they're more spacious than they are constricting. And so it's a very deprivation curiosity is a very constricting form of curiosity. It is the same level of curiosity that is behind anxiety. Well, what if this? Well, what if this? And if the worst case scenario happens and the whatever. So, and you, because you can't ever get to the answer, it becomes very more constricting the more you go down that road. Okay. The other type of curiosity that's available to us is what's called interest curiosity. Interest curiosity is us just being curious about something for the sake of being curious about it. So again, we'll go back to our ancestral and evolutionary roots. What allowed us to get out of the cave, our comfort zone, and explore the world in a way that humans became apex predators and thrivers was we got curious about the world. And not, well, what do we have to do to survive? But just like, well, what's out there? Right? It's a non-judgmental observation of cause and effect. It's a non-judgmental observation of just what's happening without any type of endpoint needing to be met. What that might look like for us is us paying attention to something, just simply looking at the cause and effect. So what you might see is that stage two of habit mapping is interest curiosity. What does this feel like is a non-judgmental question. What are you actually getting is a curious investigation about the cause and effect of a behavior in the same way that if you were doing a club fitting, you would want to go, what does it feel like to swing this club? What are the actual results that I get from this? Not a, I absolutely need it to be this, but like, tell me what it's actually producing and show me evidence to that. What this looks like for us in golf is if we find ourselves getting wrapped up in a habit that we know is unproductive, we can use interest curiosity to pop a timeout and go, huh, what am I actually getting from this response right now? Right? And instead of going, you shouldn't be responding this way or you have to respond this way, just simply showing ourselves, this is what you're getting in a really curious, non-judgmental way. What it does on a neurological level for us is the part of our brain that starts to shut down when we start to feel like we're going into our danger zone, threat zone, which is our prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that can be intentional, think rationally, think creatively, be consciously aware of stuff. When it feels a certain level of threat, it starts to shut down. Like our old brain will literally turn it off and turn it down. What interest curiosity does is it goes, okay, we're in the growth zone here. How close are we to the actual danger zone in a way that leaves that part of our brain on where it starts to be more likely to recognize, oh, things are not nearly as dangerous as I think they are, right? So maybe I'm feeling anxiety and I go, huh, how interesting, I'm feeling anxiety right now when I know that doesn't really actually produce anything good for me. Or, huh, how curious it would be. So oftentimes what that looks like is a curiosity statement in the form of, how interesting, I'm worried about these people's opinions when they actually don't have that much effect on my life. So again, I'm not telling myself, don't think this or don't do that. I'm engaging a psychological state, which is a curiosity, a non-judgmental curiosity about my internal and external environment in a way that encourages me to sit in my growth zone without retreating just because I feel uncomfortable, I've been triggered by something, et cetera, so on and so forth. So, you know, example like, huh, how interesting, I'm meeting this uphill putt that's on slow greens with a sense of anxiety. or a worry about hitting it too far when I haven't even hit the putt yet.
Yeah.
Right. And what that does is it's a kind of playful, almost silly interaction where you can hold yourself accountable to a higher level of performance and how you actually want to show up and engage with your performance without wagging the finger of judgment and shame and that harsh inner dialogue, right? And so what it does is being curious about something is a far more spacious feeling to us and works way better than things like anxiety, which is just deprivation curiosity, which again, it just creates a bunch of avoidance strategies that are about getting out of our growth zone and into our comfort zone rather than sitting in the growth zone long enough to reap the benefits thereof, right? So essentially what curiosity does, like acceptance and groundedness, is it gives us a good reason to sit in our growth zone and some discomfort and perhaps an initial triggered response in a way that goes, instead of ejecting and running back to the cave right now, let me just be curious. Let me take a look around real quick and just see what's up. Oh, actually, this isn't really as bad as I thought. Or if it is, then you could have the option to bail out if you wanted to. But for the most part, if you went, oh man, how interesting that I'm already trying to just not screw up my round of golf when I'm playing great and I have three holes left to play great instead of tucking tail and just hoping I can par my way in. How curious that I went to that response when that's not exactly what I really want to do. And what it does is it gives us a non-judgmental cause and effect where we can then intentionally make a choice about what we want to do and how we want to do it without simply reacting simply because something popped up. So that's a lot, Chase. So I can see that your gears are turning.
No, it's good. I like it. I like the, I like how the interest curiosity, like you said, gives you space to work, because it does feel, just even when I'm hearing you say it, it like feels like my heart opens up and I'm like, okay, I'm willing to go talk through this. My question to you is like, because I think when I was trying to play, I'd have a hard time not being judgmental when I was asking myself those questions. Sure. Do you find players struggle with that?
Yeah, they can, especially if your habit has been that really harsh, judgmental inner dialogue, like, why aren't you playing better? Why did you hit a crappy shot? Like all that stuff. And again, you might go, huh, how curious that I'm crushing myself or something when that makes me feel awful, destabilizes my confidence, and it doesn't help me play better golf. Now, again, you're not telling yourself don't, but you're going, okay, well, at least I'm open to a different option.
Right.
Right. So instead of just doing something because that's been my habit, and letting it run just because it exists, it offers me the opportunity to be curious about something and non-judgmental. So again, how I pose this question matters. And really what that sounds like, how interesting that you're blank when all that does is blank. And if that's not in line with the experience and the performance you want to have, now you have an opportunity to make a shift, to choose something different when the part of your brain that can choose something different is actually online rather than just running in a default response that is likely compromising your prefrontal cortex.
The other thing I keep going back to is the judgy curiosity sounds like every overbearing parent that I've ever had to work with.
100%. And by the way, that's the like, why aren't you playing better? Why did you hit that shot? Why did you pick that club instead of this club, right? So they're very well-intentioned, but the type of curiosity and questioning they're bringing to it, by the way, if I were to just ask you those questions while you're playing, and then again, imagine you're a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
How do you feel playing in that? You're super constricted. You feel intensely judged, which whether we are being judged by other people or ourselves, it doesn't feel good for us as humans. No. We tend to overvalue people's judgments, but it still doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
And then again, I ask you, well, how does that impact how you actually play? No 12-year-old plays better when their parents are crushing them with these deprivation judgment style questions. When they're coming internally, we typically don't either, right? Like, why am I playing poorly is a really difficult question to try to actually improve your performance from versus, how curious that for the third shot in a row, I've left the club face open, right? Those are two totally different things in terms of the kind of space that it feels, how open you are to feedback, and by the way, how open you are to choosing something different that might be in line more with what it is that you want to do rather than trying to avoid the things that you don't.
Okay. So let's recap this for a second on the four primary options. So we've got on time, acceptance, shocker, and then curiosity. So basically, if this makes sense, Doc. So I can be on time and I can accept all outcomes, and my results may still not be what I'm looking for. And so then that's where curiosity probably comes in, to where I'm on time, I accept all outcomes, and that's interesting. Like you said, I left the club face open. I decelled on a chip shot and chunked in the bunker, whatever the case may be, right? And so then that's where this interest curiosity can help us again. When we're in the business of forming good habits, that is a habit that can bring us back to not being judgmental, and I guess really bring us back to being on time and accepting.
Correct. So what interest curiosity does for us is allows us to respond to our external and internal environments with a sense of space that then offers us a much closer transition to, can I get back to being present and accepting and pursuing what I want rather than trying to avoid what I don't. So one of the examples we used was, you look up and you're playing great. You realize you're in the lead with a couple of holes left. Well, the best way to navigate that psychologically without dispute is to be present and to be accepting, to try to shoot the lowest score you can and continue to add to your lead, not to just hang on and hope somebody doesn't catch you. There's nobody in golf who would suggest that the latter is a better option.
Right.
So if you were to feel the sense of like, oh man, I need to just not play bad on these last couple of holes, let me just steer one out there, and you met that feeling and that knee-jerk reaction with a sense of interest, curiosity, you go, how interesting that I think the best way to play these last couple of holes is to just try to not screw it up by steering balls around. When the rest of the day I've been playing freely and the ball's gone almost exactly where I want it most of the time, then all of a sudden you go, okay, well, clearly one is a better option. Now you have the opportunity to choose in line with what you want and being more present and accepting rather than just going with something simply because it exists. Yeah. To your other point, let's say I was on time and I was accepting and I hit a shot and the ball did not go where I wanted it to. Instead of me judging myself and crushing myself, I can get curious, what led to that ball going there? Right. And then now I'm a better learner because I'm getting curious about what led to a certain outcome rather than judging myself for it and just deciding I'm good or I'm bad.
That's right. Right. No, that's
fantastic. So it's far more efficient information gathering than it is judging ourselves for it. So part of the limitation with judgment is not only that it just like feels poor and destabilizes confidence, but we're not very efficient learners when we're being judged or we're judging ourselves, because there's not a lot of viable information in it.
Yeah. No, that's good. The curiosity stuff is so good too. And like, one, were we, like I tell my players all the time, if you hit a bad shot, were you on time? Were you accepting of all outcomes? Was your game plan precise enough? Yeah. Like, as you say, on time, on target. Yes. Okay. Then maybe it was your golf swing. Then ask yourself, why did it go right? Why did it go left? You know, instead of just saying, I suck, I'm terrible, I'm never going to be good again.
Right. And the tone matter. Why did that go right is different than, I wonder what caused that to go right.
Yeah. Why did that go right?
Right. Yep. And then again, now if you start, then you start to become a better learner about your actual physical skills, about what it is for you that typically leads that, your own patterns, right? So for some players that might be, well, I left the face open and the path was to the right. For other players, that is, I shifted my weight in a way where the club face couldn't get stable anyway, and I had to dive at it or jump out of it, which left the face open, et cetera. So you become a better learner and you can adjust faster when we're meeting things with curiosity than we are with judgment.
No, that's great.
Okay. And our last option here, or at least one of the ones that the research shows us is really viable, is what we would say personal values. So while outcomes are indeed important to us, they don't offer us a ton during our performance in terms of, because they're not controllable. And by definition, they only live in the past and in the future. Or something like goals. Goals are also really valuable for us at times, but when we're actually in our performance, they don't offer us a ton of value, again, because goals only live in the future and they tend to be outcome oriented for us. So again, you could do process goals or outcome goals, but for the sake of what we're talking about here, we'll do outcome goals. What can actually be a better option for us than something like anxiety, frustration, that harsh inner dialogue, entitlements, privilege, et cetera, these types of habits that we can fall into, is really reconnecting with what's most important and most valuable to us. So values, by definition, are the principles by which we move our thoughts and actions through. So for example, winning a tournament is a goal and an outcome, a good one. a value is being competitive. Or another value might be something like playing freely. And so if we really tap into what we value, when we are living and performing based on what is most true to us, Chase, again, you'll be our reference point or thermometer here. When you are living your life and playing golf based on what you really value in the experience and in the performance, how does it feel?
Great.
Amazing. Yeah. And how does it typically impact your performance, better or worse?
Typically play better.
For typically sure. Better, right? And so again, there are a variety of different things we can value. We can value things like honesty. We can value feedback. We can value effort. And what we're looking for are, what are the things that are most true, most principles to me? And then I can use them as a leverage in my performance. So for example, let's say I find myself on the first tee going, uh-oh, okay, my anxiety kicks up a little bit. And I go, how interesting that I'm meeting this with anxiety when what I really value is being competitive. Okay, well, what would make me really competitive right now? Or what would it look like for me to make a swing that is in line with being competitive rather than being in line with worry? Now I have a self-directed information about how to play that shot instead of just the knee-jerk reaction that pops up, right? So me being clear and oriented to what I value most in my experience and what I value most that drives my performance, those are far more internally driven. When we play by them, they feel better than when we are playing by things we don't really value. And we also tend to perform better because they're drawing us into the experience and guiding us through the discomfort, the uncertainty, the stress, the vulnerability, the risk, so on and so forth, because our values are not contingent upon those things, where outcomes can be at times. Okay.
Okay. So I value playing freely.
Yeah.
My goal is to win a golf tournament. To reach that goal, my values are being competitive and playing freely.
Great.
So now, of my primary options, obviously I've been working on being on time. I've been working on accepting all outcomes. I'm going to add the interest, curiosity to ask myself better questions when things don't go exactly how I want them to go, or I don't feel exactly how I want them to feel.
Yeah.
And when I feel something that's not of the competitive nature, or I don't feel free, I'm going to ask myself, why do you feel this way when you know how much you value being free and playing competitively?
Let me reframe that a little bit. Let's use the example you had before. And you're a competitive player. Let's say you look up and you've got three holes left and you have a stroke lead and you're going in. And the knee-jerk reaction, habitual response is, ooh, just get it into the clubhouse. Don't screw it up on the way in.
Yep.
You might go, how interesting that what I really want is to win this golf tournament. And my response to that is to play safe and play scared on the way in. Then you can go, well, what do I really value? What's important to me is winning. What do I value? Being competitive and playing freely. So then now you can be able to go, okay, well, I've got three holes left. If what I value is playing freely and what I want is to win, are those two things in line? Yes, they are.
Okay.
Now, essentially what you've done is you've given your brain really good reason to stay in your growth zone, to stay uncomfortable, because playing the last couple of holes with a lead is uncomfortable because somebody could catch you and you could screw it up.
Yeah.
But the chances of you doing so by playing freely are far less than if you played scared. We know this conceptually, but in your direct experience, when you go, well, I want to play freely and I want to try to win this tournament by as many points as possible, when you get into the reasons that you would do that, which is, I really like playing freely and I value being competitive, then it's a little bit of an easier choice to go, you know what, I'm going to go for it and I'm going to play freely, than it is go, oh, let me tuck tail and just hope somebody doesn't screw up as much as I do.
Yep.
Okay. Right. So again, you can think about these behaviors. Let's say groundedness and acceptance are the things that the psychological states we really want to be in to stay in our growth zone, or when we are in there are the psychological states that are about that. Interest, curiosity, and our personal values, we might say, is us finding reasons that are credible to us to stay in there, that don't give us reason to eject as much as they give us reason to stay engaged with it. The bottom line is, if you're looking for, well, the reason for me to stay in my growth zone is if I get the outcome that I want, What are you going to do when that's not available to you?
Right.
Or what are you going to do when that's when you are vulnerable to that not being available to you? Hence why outcomes and worrying about future outcomes tends to eject us from our growth zone back to our comfort zone. Whereas if I go, I really value being competitive. I value playing freely in pursuit of the outcomes I want. Pursuit, playing freely, and being competitive are always available to us regardless of what the score is or how what setting we're in, right? Whether you're in last place or first place, those are things, again, internally driven. And when we play by them, they feel better and work better. So it's all just reasons to stay in your growth zone, stay in your growth zone rather than to eject. And then again, part of the reason that we like them is because they work better in terms of the types of outcomes that we are indeed in pursuit of.
I find it interesting that, yeah, I've played really well through 14, 15 holes. I've caught the leader. And now I feel this sense of protection and this sense of anxiousness to not screw this up, where I value playing freely. And in order for me to reach my goal of winning the golf tournament, I'm going to have a better chance of doing that if I'm playing freely. So I've got to get back into how I got to that point, which was by playing freely.
Yeah. So essentially going, how curious that I get to the lead and my default response is to hold back, to play scared, when that is not at all what I want and not at right. all what I value. Then right. essentially it's a bit of a gut check for your brain and for your nervous system and for you to go, no, it gives me good reason to take the risk is essentially what, and to be vulnerable.
Doc, if this performance consultant gig doesn't work out for you, I think you could try out for the next Sherlock Holmes role. Because every time you're like, how curious.
How curious, right? And that's that. By the way, Sherlock Holmes, it is interest, curiosity. It's very much like, sure. I'm not making a conclusion. I don't need to get to something specifically. I'm curious about the whole thing, which allows me to gather a bunch of evidence. And again, if we think about our old brain, it doesn't operate off of concepts. It operates off of evidence. And if you show it, you want to do this when the evidence is that you actually want to do this for these reasons, it's a much more powerful argument than trying to tell yourself to just trust when that trust might not be available.
It's not always available to us. And I love how you always talk about that. We don't always have access to those. Like, self-belief is great if we're always playing great, but we don't always play great. If we're always making putts, we can believe we're the best putter in the world, sure. but we don't always make putts.
And the bottom line is that there are times when that unwavering self-belief is available to us. But as you said, at the higher levels of performance, and even in our day-to-day life, like, that evidence is not always available. So then the question becomes, well, what do you do if you don't?
Yeah.
Well, if you have to believe unwavering in yourself to be able to pursue freely the things that you want, one, you're in trouble when they're not available, because either you're going to quit or you're going to bail out, or you're going to try to conjure that self-belief in a way that is not credible, in which case, then again, you're treading on thin ice. So again, I wouldn't tell anybody, if you have it and it feels really credible and you are like, no, when I say it, I actually really believe it and it's reliable, great. But if that's your primary or your only means for confidence, it's going to be unstable, because again, when we're in our growth zone, that is not always available. Yeah. By definition, our growth zone includes risk, vulnerability, which is just another way of saying discomfort and uncertainty.
For sure. Right. And we can't trick our brain. Doc, what are some other values that some of your players use? So I've written down competitive, playing freely. What are some of the other values that some of your players have had success with?
Yeah, there's somewhere, some honesty is one of them. Honesty is, one of those ones where it really helps us get better, because when we operate from what's true, we are stop projecting the future into what might be, right? So a question that you could ask to get closer to what is true is like, what is knowable right now? So if I value truth, I can use that as a leverage against anxiety or to counterbalance anxiety, because anxiety by definition is us projecting the future in a way that is imaginary, even though it might feel true. Right. And if I go, no, what is true right now? It's there's a shot in front of me. I have an opportunity in front of me, and how this is going to go is uncertain. In which case then I have because I value what is true, I can get off of what is imagined and anxious, right? Or it makes it easier for me to be able to do so in a way that's credible to me because that's what I really value. And by the way, if you really want to get better at something, valuing truth and facts is really, really powerful because, again, when you're operating from what is, not what might be or just speculation or conspiracy, you have a much more stable foundation to be able to get better from.
No, right? That's fantastic. You said pursuit. So like I want to stay in pursuit mode versus avoidance mode. Like that
pursuit
kind of
could be a strategy. It could be just like I want to pursue the things that I want in my life rather than avoiding the things that I don't. And again, avoidance in survival settings, very helpful. Please avoid all trains and walking out into traffic, right?
Fires and
but what that means, like it's almost a philosophical values-based approach to how do I want to play? Do I want to play going after the lowest scores that I can as often as I can? Or do I want to try to just sniff around the cut line and hope somebody doesn't play too well, right? Those types of things, right? Freedom is one of them. Freedom is a value. Freedom is by definition a lack of restraints. Right. And so if I value freedom, what I'm saying is what I value is not restraining my own performance, which, again, conceptually, obviously a terrible idea. But to your brain, freedom feels a whole lot better. Right. You might also value curiosity itself. You might value exploration. You know, a couple of people have asked me about Victor Hovland lately about switching coaches and perhaps taking some steps back as he retools his golf swing. And I'm like, he very clearly values learning exploring and developing knowledge.
Yeah. When you said curiosity is a primary option, I literally just thought of Victor because Victor, I mean, he's worked with 30 guys in the last 5 years. He's worked with a ton of guys.
And he's super curious. What he, if I was going to armchair with Victor, which by armchair, I mean, I don't work with him and I wouldn't pretend to know his mind, but his behavior and the, what you see at tournaments and his responses to the media is he's just super curious about golf and how it works and how you can do better. Yeah. And because of that, he's probably willing to sacrifice some short-term success because what he probably really values is long-term growth.
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
Okay, so some of the values.
A list of some of those, right? Yeah. Acceptance is oftentimes a value. Being present can also be value. So we've got a lot of overlap here.
I love it.
We can value things like discomfort. Ooh. For example, I really value discomfort because, again, the reason I value it is because it leads to growth. So what I value is growth, and therefore I also value discomfort. So if you're trying to get stronger to do that, you have to engage with things that are pushing your current capacities, and that's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right?
I like that.
You can also learn to value things like risk or vulnerability because, again, those are the things that tend to lead us to growth and to the things that we want.
So how would you have the conversation with yourself if you were in a tough spot and a high stressful situation on the golf course and your value was discomfort?
My value is discomfort.
Yeah.
It would probably, so I can give you a couple, like I've played in club championships here and you know my golf swing enough that where it has been in the past, like hitting a draw is not in my current, wasn't in my current capacity.
Right.
And so what that meant was the discomfort is if I want to get this thing in the middle of the green or near a pin, I have to start it out of bounds. And the discomfort is if I square the face on accident, it's going to go out of bounds.
Whoopsie.
Right. So there's some discomfort and also the discomfort of like, I value very much like pursuing the results I want, including winning. And the discomfort with that is if you put yourself in a position to be successful, there's always a risk of failure. Yeah. And then nobody in the world is immune to that, myself included. And that is uncomfortable, right?
So how would you have the interest curiosity question when it comes to discomfort?
So if in those two examples, it would be like, huh, how interesting you're feeling like starting this thing at the middle of the green when you know that that ain't going to cut it.
Okay. Right? Yeah. You're not aiming in the right spot. You're not taking enough.
How interesting you're thinking about taking the safe route when that is not in line with what you want.
Yeah, that's good.
Right now, again, you can talk course strategy what you want, but knowing your own game and knowing it the way that I do, I know that as the round goes on, if I'm aiming at the middle of greens and the right side is not wide open, that's not a good strategy for me.
No, that's good.
Right. Or it might be, whoo, we're coming down to the end of this tournament and you're in contention and you see there's the option of, well, I could hit a 4-iron off the tee, which is going to give me a mid iron into a green, or I can take on a bunker with the driver. And if I hit a good one, it gives me the advantage. that is not a difficult decision for me. Again, context and weather conditions play a role. Because, and that is a more uncomfortable shot, because although it might give me the advantage to win the tournament, I could also lose it there if that thing plugs in a bunker, so on
for
and
sure.
So forth, right. So essentially we're talking about, like, when anyone is faced with the risks of what does it mean to be successful for you? And then you are then vulnerable to that. That's uncomfortable. And if you value that, the reason I value that discomfort is because every time I'm uncomfortable like that and I choose what's in line with what I really want, that muscle gets stronger for me.
Yeah.
And I'm more likely to do that, not just on the golf course, but in the other areas of my life. And again, I'm not to preach my own psychology on the show. Like, that has been a game changer for my life, where instead of playing it safe in my life, I have taken the risks toward the things that I want, and they don't always pay off, but in the most important ways in my life, they absolutely have.
Yeah. And again, you're not ejecting from it. That's the one thing, like, not ejecting from the discomfort.
Right.
So I have a $1 million question for you, Doc. Did we make it through habits? Is that it?
We've made it through a good chunk of it. There's a couple more layers that if people want to get into, go get the book. I devoted an entire section of the book to habits, talking about all three stages and then a couple of different layers within those stages. People, go check it out. Not that I'm shamelessly promoting my book, but I don't know how many books out there do a more comprehensive job with habits than my book.
And if you've gotten this far with us and you don't know the book, I'm going to tell you again, I'm shocked you haven't heard it yet. Go back and listen to stage one and two on habits, because we talked about the book on there. But go to Amazon. It's Golf Beneath the Surface, same title as the podcast. After level one, stage one of habits, I thought stage two and stage three I might not survive, but it got better. Again,
you sat in your growth zone long enough that now you have reaped the benefits of doing so.
You are a great instructor. I think our next episode needs to be like a deep dive into 3D motion capture and talk about inertial sensors and go deep into all this stuff.
So that does sound good. We should do that.
I can nerd out. We can get our boy Clearwater on here at some point and talk about get him going. On some tilts and some rotations and stuff. Really good. I love how everything came back to being on time and acceptance, because it's such a big thing in what I talk to my players about practically every day, and especially with golf season kicking up here and how many late night phone calls there's been about rounds of golf and how they felt and all this stuff. And I know you get these phone calls all the time. So four primary options: be on time, accept all outcomes, interest, curiosity, and then personal values. Like, and your value can be anything from freedom, acceptance, groundedness, honesty, feedback, effort, competitiveness, playing freely, like trying to make sure that you are using that value and reminding yourself when you're getting away from there what your goal was, and that was to be accepting all day, or to be okay with the discomfort and live in it.
Or to pursue the things that you want, even when there's risk involved. Right. So again, we'll go back to our evolutionary and ancestral roots. For us to move out of the cave and to become thriving apex predators required us to be focused on what was in front of us when it was happening. That's being present.
Yep.
And accept that there is indeed risk in the world. Yep. But we cannot explore that in a way where we can thrive if I'm not willing to take that risk. There were times when we pushed into the danger zone and we had to come back, but it's that continual stretching of our growth zone that allowed humans to get to the point where we can play golf rather than just try to survive all day.
Very good. Well, Doc, thanks again for bringing me along through the three levels of habits. Like I said, the first one I was a little worried, but we made it through. We'll probably have a bunch of questions on this, I'm guessing. So we'll probably do a habits Q&A. Send the questions in to @GBTS_mindset. That's Doc's Twitter handle. Send it into @GBTS podcast on Instagram or @ChaseCooperGolf on Instagram. And we will get to those questions in the next couple of weeks, I guess. Doc, thanks again, as always. There was a lot of great stuff in these last three weeks. I'm appreciative of you. Thanks for writing the book. Thanks for getting the stuff out there. Cause like, as you kind of hinted at, and you're very humble in your approach, no one talks about this stuff as deeply as you do. And so I thank you for getting it out. I appreciate doing this with you. I appreciate our friendship. Thanks for educating me on all this stuff. Cause it's been very good for my own game and my students.
Well, if you're going to continue to flatter me like this, let's make that a habit too.
You're welcome.
That could be great.
Thanks for hanging with us. Thanks for making this what it's been. As always, reach out to us if you have any ideas of topics or you'd like anything else from us. Doc, take us home.
That's a plenty for the people. So we'd like to thank you for joining us again. Send us your questions. And in the meantime, you will see me and Chase next time on the Golf Beneath the Surface podcast. We'll see you.